The rain has gone, the weather has cooled, we're in the midpoint of November, and it's Friday. So it could be a lot worse, right? Let's go through what the weather's going to be like for the next couple of days. Highs today, first of all, of 72. First of all, 77 tomorrow. Sunday, 79. Warms to the 80s on Monday. But then by next Wednesday, it cools off. And Friday, get ready for this. Next Thursday night, Friday, a week from right now, you're going to be talking about lows in the mid-40s and high temperatures only in the 60s, which probably, to our next guest, seems like a typical summer day. But for us here, we're getting excited. Don Leonard is our guest, assistant professor of practice in city and regional planning at The Ohio State University. How you doing, Don?
I'm doing good, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm all right. What's it like in Ohio, in Columbus today? All right, in Columbus, I guess, huh?
I'm in Columbus. Yeah, it's cloudy and chilly. Those numbers already sound pretty good to me.
And are the Buckeyes headed for the national championship? What do you think?
Oh, we're number two. Absolutely.
All right, there we go. Let's talk about, speaking of number two, some of the voters in the election think the economy is like number two. I don't know. You know, I've spoken to a lot of economists throughout the election period. I'm trying to get a handle on if the economy is good, if the economy is bad. It seems as though we have a regular financial guy on that whenever the numbers come in good, that means bad. But when they come in bad, that means good. Help me understand where the economy is, Don, because I'm confused.
Well, I think you're not the only one, Tommy. There's a lot of data out there to suggest that wages are up, that prices, while they're not down, are slowing down in terms of how fast they creep up on us. Of course, we're talking about inflation there and the consumer price index. Yeah, if you look at the dashboard, you know, I think we see this kind of Wall Street picture that everything looks fine. The problem is when we go to look at Main Street or the kitchen table economics of everyday Americans, we're seeing a really different picture.
What is that picture that we're seeing?
Well, the picture is that folks are spending, you know, 30, 40, 50% of their household income on rent. You know, they're spending, if you've got a kid in daycare, you're spending 25% trying to get coverage for that. You're spending, you know, another 20-so% on your health insurance. When you add all this up, it adds up to a lot more than 100% at the end of every month. And folks are struggling out there.
So when it comes to reasonable expectations after the election, because if people did vote because of the economy and they're angry about it, they want things to change, right? I don't think people just want it to stop in terms of inflation. They want prices to come down. They want things to change or their salary to go up. Unfortunately, economically, if that happens, I think that's just going to fuel further inflation. Could be wrong. I don't know. What are realistic expectations for people that, as you said, they add everything up, it comes out to more than 100%, which puts them in a deficit spending position. And unlike the country, they can't print their own money. Well, they can, but they go to prison.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Gosh, realistic expectations. I mean, based on the cabinet appointments we're seeing coming out of Washington, D.C. right now, I don't know if anybody can forecast the future. We know that President-elect Donald Trump has promised to dramatically raise tariffs on all our trading partners, and China most of all. The Democrats tried to frame that in terms of a sales tax on the country. I think that there's truth to that. And I think that, you know, when you go into Walmart and checking tags on where stuff is made, you know, you're going to see a lot of made in China. Well, if you start, you know, raising those tariffs 20%, 30% in some cases, you're going to see higher prices. The administration is betting on, or at least this is what they campaigned on, that in the long term, that's going to bring U.S. manufacturing back home and folks are going to have better paying jobs.
But is that likely to happen?
Here's what I don't understand about the policy. If I was a company that was manufacturing in China and all of a sudden my ability to bring my stuff back into the U.S. Gets a lot more expensive because of these tariffs, obviously an option is to come back home and onshore back in the United States. But there's a lot of other countries out there besides China that have manufacturing capacity and low-cost workers. Why wouldn't they just move to Vietnam?
Well, a lot of that has already happened, has it not, Don, along the Pacific Rim? I remember having this conversation 8 years ago with somebody where because of changes in China, tariffs, what have you, or the price of labor going up and an improving standard of living in China, that it's moved along the Pacific Rim. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. You know, so I think the administration that's coming in is playing checkers with the global economy, and the global economy is more like three-dimensional chess. You know, it's got a lot more axes of movement there, and I think it's naive to think that by just pulling this one lever, we can go back to the 1950s and 60s when a person with a high school degree could make a living wage for their family.
I think everybody wants things to go back. Well, not everybody, because, you know, there were societal changes in the 50s and 60s, but everybody has this glorified memory of, you know, the golden times that they see in movies where Main Street USA and the Walgreens was on the corner of the corner drugstore, the doors were wide open, and you could walk down the street, and they think, I think they have a vision of that happening again, and that's not going to happen. I want to play this for you real quick, and you can comment on it when we come back. This is from 1980, talking about everything old is new again. 624, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Don Leonard, assistant professor of practice and city in regional planning at The Ohio State University. A text comes in. Can't help but wonder if Kamala would have won with the radio conversation this morning, still be scrutinizing new policies or praising them. Oh, man, you caught me. You got me. You got me dead to right. Yes, the conversation would be the same conversation we've been having for the last 6 months. And I don't know if you just tuned in the radio or not. Go back to your echo chamber. Have a blast. I'm not in the mood today. Don Leonard, let's talk about tariffs. The inside joke of that from Ferris Bueller's Day Off is that was Ben Stein, who was a Nixon speechwriter and an economist that delivered that line as the teacher. Talk about tariffs, if you would.
Yeah, so tariffs is this idea that you can incur pain on your trading partners in the short term by making it harder for them to sell products in your market and make your consumers happy. But in the medium term, what a lot of folks don't realize is that our trading partners can raise tariffs as well. You know, a lot of the manufacturing that happens in places like North Carolina for things like furniture, they lost all their like high volume, you know, Walmart type furniture. They're doing high end furniture now, and their number one consumer base is the, you know, 1.2 billion Chinese consumers. So you start, a tariff war with China, and all of a sudden your tariffs are going to start going up as well because they're going to retaliate.
Wait, so the North Carolina furniture manufacturers make high end furniture, but not for people here, for people in China that can afford it?
Well, they make it for people everywhere, but, you know, as somebody once said, if you figure that maybe 25% of a society is profoundly gifted, China has more gifted people than we have people. It's a very large market. So when we start cutting off Chinese imports into the U.S., guess what they're going to do?
Yeah. Talk about the vibe session, if you will, please.
Yeah, so I think maybe a little bit to your skeptical listener's text. You know, I think the Kamala Harris administration was taking a little bit of the same medicine that our consumer price index data would suggest, which is that everything looks good. We have some improvements to make in terms of, you know, prices at the grocery store and housing, and she had policies for that. But fundamentally, the establishment Democrats believe that the economy is on the right track, that it's never been stronger, and they think this is just a vibe session. They just think that voters were somehow hypnotized into thinking that everything sucks now and it used to be better 4 years earlier.
I think everybody always feels that, don't they?
Well, what's fascinating when you look at the data on like consumer sentiment, Tommy, is that it's incredible. If you're a Democrat, you feel better about the economy when Democrats are in office and vice versa. But what we can see is this overall trend that's going down. You know, when you look across all Americans in 2019, right before the pandemic clamped down on us, 50% of Americans described their household financial situation as good or excellent. By the election year here, 2024, that had fallen to 41%. So a lot fewer Americans think that their household finances are in good shape now than they did 4 years ago. That's not a vibe session.
Let me ask you this. It seems as though the cart has now been placed before the horse, in that instead of the economics of the country driving politics, the politics are driving the economics. And what I mean by that is, if 4 years from now prices go up, people that voted for this administration, and I hope to God the prices come down, but if they go up, they're going to explain it away for one reason or the other and blame it on somebody else. Conversely, even if the prices do come down, the Democrats are going to explain it away on something else and not give the Republicans credit. Accurate or not?
No, I think that's true. You know, the spin rooms are alive and well on both sides of the aisle. I think the scary thing for me is that who do they blame? You know, we already are being told that that, you know, on the left, it's Bernie and his war against the billionaires. On the right, it's Donald Trump and the war against immigrants and the Chinese as being the ones to blame for our lot in life. But, you know, the simple fact is, when economic times get hard, people look for scapegoats, and that starts getting into some scary territory. You ran that clip about U.S. Economics going into the 1930s. There was a lot of global economics going on at that point as well. And when prices start going up, you start seeing really scary stuff in the political side.
And people lose sight of the fact that instead of getting caught up in all of that, the main concern is just putting groceries on the table. That's all we're looking for, right? To feed our families, go on a vacation every now and then?
Absolutely. Americans work so damn hard, and they're just trying to get a living wage for themselves and, you know, a fair shake for their kids.
That's all we're looking for. Thank you, Don. Appreciate your time. Dr. Don Leonard, Assistant Professor of Practice in City and Regional Planning at The Ohio State University. Go Buckeyes. I'll say that because LSU beat Ohio State for national championship not too long ago, didn't we? Yeah. 6:30, we'll talk to Jeff Palermo about LSU when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. It all happens tomorrow. LSU taking on the Florida Gators. I guess I should tell you first that it's 6:44, 16 till 7, Friday morning, November 15th, here at WWL. Just a beautiful morning. 56 degrees outside, going up to only 72 tomorrow. LSU taking on the Gators at the Swamp in Florida. I don't know if a cold front will have reached there by then or what kind of temperatures they'll be playing in. Our coverage starts at 10 a.m. Tim, can you look that up, please? Thank you. Coverage starts at 10 a.m. with Mike Dettelier and Herb Tyler, former Tiger quarterback. Always great perspective from both of them. Doors open at 11 o'clock at Acme Oyster House in Baton Rouge for the Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Tiger Tailgating Show presented by MAP Construction. Before that, just head out to Acme Oyster House and hang out outside of the window like they do for the Today Show. It's always a great time with Mike and Herb. Acme has 16 surround sound TVs, great drink specials. Life's more fun with seafood. So hang out and watch a game there. You can catch LSU's pregame at 12:30. Kickoff with Chris Blair and Jacob Hester at 2:30. Tigers Gators tomorrow on WWL. And a free Odyssey app, supposed to be 70 and sunny in the Swamp tomorrow. So pretty much ideal conditions. Jeff Palermo joins us now. WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director, and our good friend. How you doing, Jeff? Jeff, you got me muted? Jeff, you on the headset?
How you doing, Tommy? How you doing?
Come in, Jeff.
Hey, Tommy, 10-4. Can you hear me?
10-4, over and out. Hey, tell me about LSU and Florida.
Well, obviously, it's a game for both teams that are trying to get a win, right? They've lost, each of them have lost a couple games in a row. Florida had a really difficult stretch there, having to play Georgia and Texas in back-to-back games. I think most teams that would play those two teams in back-to-back weeks would end up losing. And in the process, Florida lost its starting quarterback. They had already lost their starter at the beginning of the season, and then DJ Lagway, who is their big-time freshman from Texas, ends up injuring his hamstring in the Georgia game. They got to go to a third-string quarterback, a transfer from Yale, who is very limited. And Florida really just got beat pretty bad last week in Austin, losing to Texas. And then we all know about what happened to LSU. I mean, it's just amazing, Tommy, how this season – I don't want to say it's spiraled out of control, but just how it changed when you go back to where you were at halftime of that Texas A&M game. You're up by 10 points. Mm-hmm. Garrett Nussmeier is, you know, looking like a Heisman candidate out there. He's thrown for over 200 yards against the Aggies. Shut down Texas A&M's offense. And you know, one interception leads to a quarterback change for the Aggies, and all of a sudden the season has gone downhill here. But this is a chance for LSU to get it right, get back into the win column. This is a Florida team that has been ravaged with injuries, not only at the quarterback position, but the running back position in the defensive secondary. And, you know, LSU is the more talented team, and it's really going to come down to, as long as LSU stays away from the turnovers, you know, Nussmeier takes care of the ball and reverts back to the guy that we saw for most of the season, I think LSU should win this game.
You know, I don't know if it's the election aftermath or what, but it seems like that Alabama game was a month ago, doesn't it? At least
yeah,
to me it does.
Maybe so. It seems like it's been a long time since LSU's won a game. You know, that's for sure. And it has been, because you had the A&M game, and then you had the bye, and then Alabama loss. And, you know, this LSU football program just doesn't have too many, you know, two-game losing streaks. So it's really the biggest, I would say, the biggest adversity point since Brian Kelly's been here. There's been questions about the program and your questions about, you know, whether you should be benching your quarterback. These are things that Brian Kelly really has not had to address since being here at LSU. So it's really time for LSU to respond. It's time for Nussmeier to respond. And again, you're going up against a team that's not very good defensively, has trouble. You're not, you know, even if DJ Lagway plays, and he is expected to play, he's expected to start. Billy Napier, the Florida head coach, announced it last night on his coach's show that Lagway will play. I can't imagine he's going to be that mobile out there. This was a guy 2 weeks ago in that game against Georgia that was taken off on a cart. And so I don't expect him to be just, you know, doing his best Jalen Milroe impersonation against LSU's defense. So this is why I call this a get right game for LSU to you know, get back on the stable footing, get a win under its belt, and then really try to finish it off with two games at home, and see what 9-3 gets you when it's all said and done.
He is a sizable feller, 6'3", 225. What was the injury, do you know?
He had a hamstring injury. Okay. Hamstring injury.
And yeah. He's playing hurt, basically, is what we're saying.
He's playing hurt. And again, it's surprising. You know, when you saw him get hurt against Georgia, you said, well, okay, looks like, you know, he's not going to be available for LSU. But it is because he was carted off the field. And again, usually guys that are carted off the field with a leg injury, you know, first of all, it's usually a knee injury, of course, or an ankle or something like that. But when you're talking about a hamstring injury, those are things that are, you know, 4 or 6 weeks. But here he is. He's back 2 weeks later.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. With all that being said, LSU just a 3.5-4 point favorite, which kind of gets my attention because usually they know some. I know you got a story you just posted about Brian Kelly and Garrett Nussmeier. We'll talk about that as well. Jeff Palermo, you can find his article at WWL.com, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. More about the Tigers and the Gators when we come back. 6:51 now, 9 till 7. Traffic on a beautiful Friday morning on WWL. All right, 6:56 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. I was saying the other day, Jeff, I think Garrett Nussmeier's problems, I don't think it's a mechanics problem. I think the problem is between his ears. Thoughts?
Well, and I think another thing that Brian Kelly brought up this week is that because of the lack of a running game, and actually, he's obviously said it more than once, not just this week, but because of the lack of a running game, he's going out there feeling like he's got to do it. You know, he's putting more pressure on himself. And especially you go back to that interception he threw to begin the second half against Alabama. You know, there's just no faith in the running game once they get inside the 20-yard line that they can hand the ball off a couple times and get the ball across the goal line. So he's got to go out there and make a play, and he's got to feel like, hey, I got to, you know, I see this window here in the end zone. I'm going to try to thread the needle and get the ball to my receiver and score a touchdown. And, yeah, I think just the lack of a, a true running game has just, it's just kind of spiraled into the issues now with Garrett Nussmeier.
It's a great point. Let's talk about your story here. I'm looking at WWL.com. Here's what has to happen for LSU to reach the SEC title game. And really,
yeah,
it's not that far-fetched. Do you want to take us just through this weekend?
Yeah, well, you know, this weekend, I mean, LSU, you're right. I mean, it's just they got to win, you know, just a simple amount of – or obviously, first of all, LSU's got to win its final three games, right? I mean, for this to happen. But then when you look at what has to happen beyond that, really all the game it would basically be all the teams that are favored are supposed to win. And so for this week – LSU fans need to be rooting for Texas to beat Arkansas, which is most likely going to happen. Georgia has to beat Tennessee. Now, that's kind of a...
That's the only one that worries me.
Yeah, that's a toss-up game, no doubt about it. And then South Carolina has to beat Missouri. But then even when you look beyond that, Tommy, A&M's got to beat Auburn. Ole Miss has got to beat Florida. That should happen. Missouri's got to beat Mississippi State. That should happen. Alabama's got to beat Oklahoma. That should happen. Texas has to beat Kentucky. That should happen. And then you go to the final week, Ole Miss should beat Mississippi State in the Egg Bowl. Alabama should beat Auburn in the Iron Bowl. Missouri should be favored to beat Arkansas, but that's another toss-up game. And then Texas beats A&M and Tennessee beats Vandy. So certainly not out of the question, but it is November. Tommy, yeah. And strange things certainly happen in November and games, and we've already seen
and have happened already
in the SEC.
Exactly. First thing LSU got to do is win out. That's the first thing they got to do. And Georgia's playing Tennessee between the hedges, not at Rocky Tap, but Tennessee's got a hurt quarterback, I think, so we'll see how it unfolds. Thank you, Jeff Palermo. Have a great football weekend. WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. When we come back, we're going to spend an hour talking about the special session and looking at both sides of it with Jan Moeller, Invest in Louisiana, Aaron Bendeley, Pelican Institute, and more when we come back. 7:14, beautiful Friday morning, going to be a beautiful weekend. Highs today of only 72, 77 tomorrow, warming to 79 on Sunday. But get ready next week by the 1 week point to Thanksgiving next Thursday night, Friday morning, highs in this of only 60 and lows in the mid-40s. So we got some nice fireplace weather coming. We're going to spend an hour talking about the governor's tax reform program. Special session that's going on in his plans for tax reform and thoughts on it. We'll start with Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana. Then we'll go to Aaron Bendeley, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute. And I'm guessing they see it a little differently. Good morning, Jan. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, Tommy.
Tell me about your thoughts as to what the governor's proposing and where it stands now in the session.
Well, so we're about halfway through the session. The governor, I will give him credit for having big ambitions when it comes to tax policy. But from our perspective, Tommy, this was the wrong plan at the wrong time. You know, the governor is trying to do two big things. He wants to pass, you know, the biggest constitutional overhaul that we've seen in Louisiana in a half a century, and also probably the biggest changes to the tax structure that we've seen in a half a century. And when the smoke clears from all this, and remember, the governor in his opening speech said that he wants this entire package to pass and that this thing is meant to be a whole package. You can't just pass pieces of it. Our concern with the overall package is that when the smoke clears, if it passes, Louisiana would not be solving a budget shortfall. It would actually be creating a massive budget shortfall and setting the stage for deep budget cuts to programs and services. It's just not going to raise as much money as we need to run state government. So that's our concern with the plan. We're at about the halfway point. The House has been working on this plan. Tax bills have to start in the House. So first it's the House and then the Senate. And it turns out there are a lot of people in the House who are very eager to cut taxes. So the bills that cut the income tax and cut the corporate franchise tax, those passed pretty easily. There aren't quite as many legislators who want to raise other taxes to pay for those tax cuts. So yesterday, there was a bill to renew the sales tax that's expiring. That bill passed with just one extra vote to spare after a lot of amendments were made. And then the second part, which was to expand the state sales tax to include services, 41 different services that the governor wants to tax, that bill didn't even come up for debate because they don't have the votes. So we're at a kind of an impasse now as this plan moves to the Senate, because, again, the governor said that this has to pass as an entire package, but we have a long way to go. They have until a week from Monday to finish their business.
My concern going in was that, okay, you want to do this to get away from all the carve-outs, but guess what? As you try to either eliminate carve-outs or add taxes to other things, those people that are the beneficiaries of the carve-outs or are going to be the targets of the new taxes are going to say, whoa, hang on a second. They're going to start calling the legislators. Legislators are going to react, and we wind up with something that's even more jumbled than it was when we started. Am I on anything here?
Absolutely. And look, one of the problems with and that's part of the issue as this plan goes to the Senate. So let's talk about just one bill in this package. You talk about carve-outs. The governor's plan calls for cutting this the corporate income tax by more than half. Corporations, the companies that pay this corporate income tax, by and large, are the very big companies. You think petrochemical companies, Exxon, companies like that. He wants to cut that tax in half, but to minimize the cost of that tax cut, he wants to get rid of some of the tax credit programs that we have. And what that would do is, you know, he wants to eliminate the movie tax credit. If you do that, you're going to kill the film industry in New Orleans. There's a tax credit for historic preservation that gets used to bring a lot of old, dilapidated buildings. Think of downtown redevelopment projects, housing projects. That credit would go away, and so would a lot of those projects. There's just a lot of development that wouldn't get done. There's a tax credit for digital and interactive media that's responsible for bringing a whole lot of technology jobs to New Orleans. So there's some, and so if those tax credits go away, you're killing entire industries that bring jobs and economic activity to parts of Louisiana. And so absolutely, the defenders of those credits have been in the room defending those credits. And so if you're looking at this bill now in the Senate, you have to kind of ask yourself a question. Do I want to give a tax cut to the shareholders of ExxonMobil, or do I want to keep filmmakers and these small builders and these new tech companies in New Orleans and other places? That's a difficult choice for legislators, but that's one reason we're seeing a lot of skepticism around this plan.
So when you're talking about reducing the corporate income tax by half, I don't know, are we at risk of corporations leaving because of the income tax, or do we know of any corporations on the horizon that, given all the other problems the state has, are going to come in because you've reduced that income tax by half?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, if you ask the Department of Economic Development, they'll say that there are companies that don't consider Louisiana because of the corporate income tax. But again, very few companies in Louisiana pay the corporate income tax at all. You have to be organized as a C-Corp, not an S-Corp, to pay that tax. And again, it's mostly the large national, multinational companies. You know, think about the companies that have plants along the Mississippi River, or big companies like Walmart that might have, you know, operations across Louisiana pay this tax. And again, it's a tax that's essentially paid by the shareholders of those companies. We don't know what would happen if they do that, but we do know that if you cut the corporate income tax and you eliminate these tax credits, then there are some very important industries in Louisiana that would simply go away. The film industry does not exist in Louisiana without the film program, the film tax credit. We heard last week from some tech companies, from New Orleans, who said, you know, the only reason we can exist in a place like New Orleans, where there isn't as much, high tech talent as a place like Austin or Silicon Valley or New York, is because there's this tax incentive that encourages them to operate there.
We take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana. Aaron Bendeley, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute, I'm sure sees this differently. We'll talk to her in the next half hour, 7:21 and a half. Time for traffic now, WWL. 7:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana, pleading his case, if you will, about the governor's tax reform plan. Jan, there are always going to be winners and losers whenever you change anything, right? So in this instance, let me take a step back first. You mentioned budget shortfall and cuts. People are confused. They think John Bel Edwards left the state with a surplus. Did he? And where does a budget shortfall or fiscal cliff come from?
Well, yes. I think one of the stories we don't tell about John Bel Edwards enough is how much money he left in the state savings accounts. When he took over from Bobby Jindal, the state had about $200 million sitting aside in its rainy day fund, because that fund had been tapped so many times under the previous governor to keep the budget balanced. You know, the state has to balance its budget every year. During the 8 years that John Bel Edwards was governor, that those rainy day funds, we have two rainy day funds, went from about $200 million to almost $4 billion. So we have a lot of money in the savings accounts, in large part thanks to those surpluses that we ran. And one of the parts about Landry's tax plan is that they want to raid some of that money to pay down some of these tax credit obligations. So there's a lot of money coming out of the state savings accounts if this plan passes. But again, the budget shortfalls come from the fact that if this plan passes, we're going to be raising a lot less revenue for state government than we are right now. And when you bring in less revenue, you have to balance that with budget cuts. The Legislative Fiscal Office's own numbers show that the plan, when you take it, when you balance out the tax cuts and the tax increases, we're going to bring in about $600 million less than we are bringing in right now. And that means you're going to have to cut. And we all know what gets cut in those situations. It's education, it's college and university funding, it's healthcare. It's public services that people use and need. And so we have a generation of legislators, particularly in the House, who've never been through these times of hardship when state government is struggling to balance the budget and make cuts that sometimes can hurt the state for years to come, because they haven't seen it in 8 or 9 years. Back to the fiscal cliff, Tommy. The fiscal cliff is something the legislature created, and that is because the last time we had a budget crisis in 2018, they put some new sales taxes on the books, but they scheduled those taxes to expire at the end of June of next year. So the legislature created the fiscal cliff. They could solve this fiscal cliff pretty easily by simply renewing those taxes, but the governor decided to use this this small crisis as an excuse to kind of take an entire, you know, again, a very ambitious plan to restructure the tax structure that we have in Louisiana. But again, I think when you add up the numbers, the math isn't mathing.
And if I remember correctly, there was a hell of a fight to get it to 0.45 cents on a dollar, because it was at a penny, right?
Absolutely. And it took them three special sessions in 2018. I remember some of those plans passed, moments before midnight. So there was a lot of blood, sweat and tears to get that compromise. And I understand, you know, nobody runs for office because they want to raise taxes on constituents. It's, spending money is the easy part. Everybody wants to fund the programs that people need. Raising the money to pay for that is a much harder thing. So, look, I appreciate the hard work that the legislature is undertaking. And I know we're probably running out of time, Tommy, but people need to understand that we have an entire session coming up in the spring, a fiscal session when the legislature is supposed to look at these problems. There is really no reason to do this in the middle of November, especially because we don't have a budget in front of us. The budget doesn't even get released until February. So legislators have no way really of telling which programs are going to get cut if they cut these taxes that the governor's asking for.
Thank you, Jan. 7:30, we'll take a break. Talk to Erin Bendeley on the other side, Vice President of Policy and Strategy for the Pelican Institute. She sees it differently. They do. We'll talk when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. All right, we're talking about Tommy Tucker, WWL, 744, 16 till 7. Beautiful day, beautiful weekend. Chilly outside, nice and clear and sunny. And we're, 57 degrees. We're talking about the governor's tax reform plan and where it stands in legislative special session. We spent a half hour with Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana. Now we're going to spend some time with Erin Bendeley. Erin Bendeley, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute, whom I'm guessing sees it a different way. How you doing, Erin?
I'm doing well, Tommy, and you?
I'm okay. I'm not against the plan. I'm against a screw job is what I'm against, as I think most people are. So explain, not in those terms, but as far as winners and losers, what is the governor and what is the Pelican Institute looking for here? Who are going to be the winners and who maybe will not benefit as much? I hate to use the term loser because that's pejorative, but who's going to benefit from this? Who will not benefit from this?
Well, we certainly hope it's the Louisiana people who benefit from this. We have been working on this for quite some time, as you know. Our goals, and I think the goals of the governor and most of those in the legislature, as they have shown in the past week and a half, are really looking to do a few things here. One, they're looking to provide relief to the Louisiana people. Two, they're looking to make our state more competitive, bring back jobs, bring back our kids and grandkids, stop the out-migration that we have been experiencing since 2016, year after year. We've lost about 120,000 people since then, and it's time for change. And so through this tax plan, I believe that the hope and I believe what we will actually achieve is providing that relief through lowering and flattening income taxes, both on the personal side and on the corporate side, making the entire system fairer so that everyone contributes and stop this system of winners and losers and preferences for those that have the lobbyists and the attorneys to fight for themselves, and many others don't, and then that makes everyone else have to pay more. We're looking to simplify our tax code, which we have been criticized by all of the national experts for so many years, saying that this is one of the top reasons why businesses choose not to come here, is figuring out our extremely complex tax code. And finally, and I would say this is a huge piece of this, a big priority for us, and that is making sure that we set ourselves up for sustainability over time, and that involves restraining the growth of spending. Our state has increased state spending by 35% since 2015, 84% in the last decade, to the point that at the same time when we're losing people, that's just not a sustainable place to be. We've got to look at reining in the growth of government closer to what the people can afford.
Where does the program stand now? Because one concern I had going into this, and I may have asked you about it, is that, you know, you start by wanting to get away with all the different carve-outs and exceptions, but then it seems as though I knew going into it that those that were getting the carve-outs and exemptions were going to be concerned. Also, those to whom the burden to make up getting rid of the revenue, the taxes, or flatter taxes, that burden would fall to somebody who's not going to like it as well. They're going to have pushback on that. So my concern was that you wind up with an even more convoluted mess. Thoughts?
Well, and that's certainly been the, you know, a topic of conversation in this past week and a half as these bills have been making their way through the House. Certainly everyone who is benefiting from one of these exemptions or preferential treatment in the code, they have their lobbyists show up. And, you know, we've even seen some local government representatives show up this week. Certainly the beneficiaries of that for a long time have a lot to say on this. On the other hand, it's, you know, also easy to point out that at some point you've got to recognize that our system, when you look at the entire tax code of Louisiana, we have 564 deductions, exclusions, or exemptions. If you're one of those, I'm sure you're coming out on top, or you certainly feel like you are. But in the grand scheme of things, There are a lot of people who feel like that's unfair. And all the experts, again, will tell you that's just not the way to design a tax policy that makes your state competitive in the end. It's really not. And so we've got to look at, trying to reverse some of this. But at the same time, there are some that I think lawmakers are sensitive to. They're sensitive to the concerns that are being brought by a lot of the beneficiaries of these things. I think there's still room for some wiggle room if they're not taken out of these bills. I think we've heard from the Department of Economic Development that they're open to maybe continuing some incentives in a different way. It doesn't have to be through a tax preference. Maybe it's a grant program or a subsidy or some sort of other economic incentive that they can do in a different way.
But with all that being said, somebody texted in. I want to get the texts here. Let me take a break for traffic first, and we'll get to some of the texts. Somebody texted in and wants to know which state has the most growth and why. Somebody else texted in and said this tax reform bill is being billed as a panacea to attract businesses and prevent people from leaving the state, when in fact it's all about insurance. Somebody else wants to know about numbers don't lie. How are you going to replace the money that they're getting rid of? So you can talk about all that when we come back. Ren Bendeley, our guest, Vice President for Policy and Strategy, the Pelican Institute. All I want is what's best for the state. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Bendeley, Vice President for Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute. Aaron, some of the texts that came in, people leaving in the state because, let me get back to the first one I asked you about, which was states that have the most growth and why, and combining that with the one that said this is being sold as a panacea for people leaving the state and attracting business, when in fact it's a lot more complicated than that. Thoughts?
Well, I'll take the last one first. I certainly don't believe that this alone is going to solve all of the challenges that we have in our state. However, that said, we think this is a huge problem that must be tackled. But certainly in addition to fixing our tax code, making our state more competitive, providing relief in people's pocketbooks, we know that we still have to work to improve our educational system. We have to work to make sure that we effectively move people out of poverty into self-sufficiency through work. Lots of things that we need to do to address a number of needs. So I agree with that. For the first question, as to what states do we look to then, I think a couple of states have been mentioned over the past week and a half. Certainly North Carolina, which has engaged in quite a bit of tax reform over the years. They have a lower, flatter personal income tax. They also have a lower, more competitive corporate income tax rate. They've implemented a lot of other reforms that I think have caught people's attention. Texas, our neighbor, has no personal income tax, no corporate income tax. And then there are eight other states across the country that have no personal income tax. So again, no tax system is perfect. You know, lots of people do these things differently when they assemble their system of individual income taxes, corporate income taxes, sales taxes, property taxes. But I would say, you know, in the grand scheme of things, Louisiana is ranked 40th overall for tax competitiveness by the Tax Foundation. And at the same time, we are just one of three states that has a corporate income tax, a corporate franchise tax, and a corporate inventory tax. So when you put all of that together, it's no wonder why businesses are not even giving us a second look, and we've got to get beyond that.
Aaron, this is so complicated, and there are so many offshoots. I guess maybe we could use the time that's left for you to address the average Louisiana citizen and explain to them why this would be in their best interest, at least as far as the Pelican Institute is concerned.
Well, what we believe is, you know, pretty immediately we think people will notice a difference in their own pocketbooks. Longer term, we firmly believe that if we do this right, as other states have done, we will start seeing the benefits and seeing benefits in the form of jobs being more available here, more businesses coming into our state, people just giving Louisiana another chance. I mean, again, I'm back to the out-migration that we've experienced. We all have family members and friends that we have lost to other states, many of these states that I just mentioned. These are some of the things that bring people back. It's time to bring back opportunity to our people.
How concerned are you that part of it gets passed and not the other part, and that we wind up with a bigger mess than we had when we started?
Well, that's something that, you know, again, the governor has been very vocal about, as well as legislative leadership. This is a package, and it's important to take it as a package. Now, that doesn't mean that things can't be amended and that the package can't evolve through the legislative process. We know that it will, and it has to some extent. But, you know, I'm optimistic. I have to give a shout out to House members who voted overwhelmingly for almost all of these bills over the past week and a half. I think they've got one more on sales taxes that they didn't get to yesterday. The legislature will come back on Monday. We're hearing good things from the Senate, but certainly, you know, they will have their own questions and their own priorities. So we're optimistic that this is going to get done, and it's going to involve a little bit of, you know, all of these things that we discussed, several bills, how they put them together at the end to make sure that the net effect is that we are providing relief, we are making the state competitive, we are simplifying our system, and we are reducing the growth of government. Those are the things that we're going to be looking to and how we will judge success at the end of this special session.
Thank you, Aaron. I appreciate your time. Vice President of Policy and Strategy at the Pelican Institute. When we come back, we're talking Mike Dettelier about the Saints, Browns, and LSU Gators here on WWL. Tell me that doesn't make you smile hearing that. I remember jumping up and down, hugging my kid, twirling around the room thinking I was going to pass out. It went dark and my knees got weak. Mike Dettelier, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Tommy. Thanks.
That made you smile, didn't it? How can it not?
It sure did. Not once, but twice and three. Hearing it again, but because you knew at that moment that was they had won it.
That's exactly right.
You knew it.
And I remember, man, yeah, I'm sure all of us have moments that we spent with her. Matter of fact, text me, 504-260-1870. If you remember where you were when that happened, because honestly, for the first time in my life, I thought I was going to pass out. The room went darker. My knees got weak because, like you're saying, Mike, that sealed it. We knew that we won the Super Bowl. Long time ago, a lot of ground between then and now. But let's talk about the ground between the Atlanta, Carolina game and the Atlanta game, and the ground between the Atlanta game and the Browns game, and the difference in the team.
Well, the big difference this week will be you got your center back in Eric McCoy. This team has not played the same offensively since Eric McCoy went down very early in the Eagles game. And their running attack has been almost stagnant. Eric's a really good football player, and he's one of the few guys on this team. He could start for any team in the NFL. If at not at center, he could start at left or right guard. He's that good. And so you're getting him back in the lineup, and that's a big plus for this football team. You sort of beat up in the secondary, and that's the big change, and Lattimore was traded off. So on the back end, that's where I think teams are going to try to go after you. But they haven't stopped the run all year, Tommy. So why would I sort of get away from that? And I know Nick Chubb is not the same guy as he was 2 years ago. Nick, arguably, he was one of the top two running backs in the NFL. And he has a knee injury. I really question if he could ever come back from it. Yeah. And he's back. How much back is in question?
Mike, getting back to Eric McCoy, you remember years ago when I sat you down and I told you about the importance of being the center on the offensive line in the NFL. Remember that when I told you that story? When I sat you down?
Yeah, I remember.
Remember you came to me and you said, Tommy, teach me about football. And I said, all right, Mike, have a seat. And then and I tell you about the
No, but Eric,
I tell you about the importance of no. But seriously, tell people what you taught me, and you taught us all about the importance of the center in the NFL. Go ahead.
I always believe it's the second hardest position to play in football. Quarterback's the first, but the center, he basically directs all the other offensive linemen. He's the communication guy. And today it's even a little bit more difficult because I think maybe in years past, most of the blitzing was coming off the edge. Today, it's coming up the middle. And there's delay blitzes and everything else they want to shoot at you. And so you better have a guy that knows what the hell he's doing.
And on these delayed blitzes, they are so quick. It's amazing that a guy can get from 5 yards deep in the backfield, looking like he's in coverage, to in the face of the quarterback in the blink of an eye. It's amazing how quick they are and how they disguise them.
And when you look at it, that quarterback, when he catches the ball from the snap, he is eyeing, because that guy's right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
He watches him running toward him. It affects everything, and it affects where you throw the football to try to blow up your launch pad. And when that guy's running through, you visually catch him.
Well, first and you're trying to catch a snap.
Everything.
You're trying to catch a snap and keep an eye on
Correct.
Him to determine whether or not he's coming. So if you want to play quarterback in the NFL, you got a lot going on. Oh, and by the way, there are reads and progressions you got to go through. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back tomorrow. LSU taking on the Gators at the Swamp in Florida. Tim tells me the weather's going to be about 70 degrees and nice. Coverage starts at 10 a.m. with our own Mike Dettelier and former Tiger quarterback Herb Tyler. They have great chemistry together, great insights. Doors open at 11 o'clock. The show starts at 10, I think. Right, Mike?
At 10, correct.
10. The doors open at 11, so you can go hang around outside the windows like they do at NBC on a Today Show. Then 11 o'clock, they open the doors at Acme Oyster House at Baton Rouge, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Tiger Tailgating Show. It really is fun to listen to with both Herb and Mike and their insights. It's presented by Map Construction. Acme's got 16 surround sound TVs, great drink specials. Pregame at 12:30 from LSU. Kickoff with Chris Blair and Jacob Hester at 2:30. Hang out, watch the game at Acme. Get it started with Mike and Herb. Doors open at 11. Coverage starts at 10 tomorrow on WWL. 8:22. Traffic now, WWL. 8:27 now on this Friday morning, November 15th. Saints taking on Jameis Winston and the Browns. Mike, you know, Maya Angelou once famously said, when somebody shows you who they are, believe them. I think Jameis Winston has shown us who he is, has he not?
Okay, just like we talked about Derek Carr, he is who he is.
Yep.
There's going to be the roller coaster ride with him. That's never going to change with him. Jameis is the exact same way. You can watch him throw a football, and he make a couple throws. You say, wow, look at that. I mean, right on target.
And then, wait a minute. And then he'll make a couple of throws, and you'll say, wow, look at that, right?
And no, you're saying, why did he throw that?
Yeah, completely you know, different. But you're using the same words, just completely differently, right?
Yeah, in maybe a few adjectives. But that is the way Jameis is going to be. For the rest of his career. That's the way Derek Carr is going to be the rest of his career. There are certain books kind of on certain people and everybody that plays in the NFL. He gets hot, man. He can tear you up throwing the football. But the last time he played, we saw one touchdown, three interceptions. And he could have had a fourth. The guy dropped it. The first game, he was really good. But he threw two passes up. The Ravens dropped interception. So you understand that he is going to make some big plays for you, and he's going to also create an opportunity for the defense to make a big play.
Now, I don't want you to answer this on the air. I'm just going to ask you if you know the answer, and I'll see if people can text in with the answer, okay? What do Jameis Winston and Joel Osteen have in common? Don't answer it, Mike. I think you know the answer, but we'll just leave it and see if the audience knows. Tell me about Jerry Jeudy.
Jerry was first-round pick wide out from Alabama. He's one of the best wide receivers Alabama had produced in years, him and Julio Jones. And he sort of had a bit of a rocky road in the NFL. But him and Jameis sort of on the same wavelength. And he looks for Jerry Jeudy. In watching the film, he sort of tilts his head toward Jerry Jeudy on almost every play. He's watching to see where Jeudy is out on the field. So He's a guy that I think Winston wants to feed the football to. The other guy is Njoku at tight end. The Saints have had difficulties covering athletic tight ends. Njoku is a really good tight end in this business.
He made headlines a couple of years ago, if I remember right. That's when he kind of burst on the scene 2 years ago?
Yeah, he was a first-round pick wide out from Miami of Florida, but he's really good.
And then we got to talk about the Cleveland defense, too, and who their guy is. We know who it is. We'll talk about it when we come back. If you know the answer to that question, what do Joel Osteen and Jameis Winston have in common? You can text me, 504-260-1870, 830, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Mike Dettillier, talking about the Saints and the Browns. Mike, let's talk about that Browns defensive line, because although they're 2-7, I guess it is, they got a stud on a defensive line.
They sure do. Miles Garrett, Texas A&M player, he was the first overall pick in the draft a few years back. And Tommy, he did something 2 weeks ago I have not seen since J.J. Watt did it with the Houston Texans. They played the Chargers. And knowing Jim Harbaugh, his deal is, hey, man, we ain't scared of no Miles Garrett. We know we can block him. He normally is situated at left defensive end, which means he goes up against a right tackle. And that guy was Joe Alt, a very high first-round pick in the April draft. In four consecutive plays, over two series, he had three sacks. It was, we got to drop that plan. That's not working. But in four plays, in over two series, three quarterback sacks. Every other down after that, he had a tight end or a running back helping his right tackle. That's how dominant a player Miles Garrett is. And he redirects your game plan because you think you can block him one-on-one, but, you know, he teaches you you can't. So in this game, one of the matchups to watch, Miles Garrett at left defensive end going up against Trevor Penning. And we, listen, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen development in Trevor Penning. He's played better than what we've seen in the past. Man, you talking about you passed a couple of tests now. Now you're given a midterm and a big one when you got to go up against a guy like Miles Garrett.
Tell me who scored well last week. They said they had the best game of his career. Was that 70? Is that Trevor
Penning? Trevor Penning.
Yeah. And that's
Trevor, it was the best I've ever seen him play in the Saints uniform. He was always a good run blocker, but I thought he did a nice job in pass protection. One of the things in noticing how he plays, I thought over the first 2 years of his career, he was taking the blows as an offensive lineman, which you don't like to see. That guy pushes you back. Well, he was delivering the blows in pass protection. Mm-hmm. You could see, man, those arms were coming out, and he didn't let that defensive end sort of shock him at the point of attack. Well, you better get ready this week because Miles Garrett will do this one maneuver. He'll give you an outside move, and then you kind of set up outside, and then he cuts it real hard inside, and he beats you. That's what exactly thing he did Alt. The first two sacks were outside sacks, and then, you know, Alt starts to set up for an outside move. He cuts it inside. Straight shot to Justin Herbert. So you better be cognizant of Miles Garrett because he can change a game, and you can't go one-on-one with him. You've got to get a tight end or a running back to kind of chip and sort of help out. Here's the crazy thing about the Browns. Miles Garrett's a really good football player. He's one of the top three players in the NFL defensively. Their secondary is the strength of their team. Tommy, they don't have a one interception this year. Not one. That, to me, is shocking because you look at that secondary is talented, really talented. And one of the guys back there is Grant Delpit. People remember him, former LSU All-American. But they have no interceptions this year. None.
Tell me about the Honey Badger and kind of baiting Jameis Winston a little bit with that sound bite. Every time I think he's done, he comes up with a big play. Thoughts on how the Saints and Ugo Amadi, I think, played pretty well last week, considering. Thoughts on the Saints secondary, Mike?
I think Jameis is going to go after the cornerbacks. You know, he knows them and they know him, okay? Because he's been there. He's went up against these guys in practice. So for the Saints, you got to be able to move him around. When he can stay in that pocket, and he is a pocket passer, and you let him throw, that's when he's dangerous. When he's not effective is when you got him moving and he got to throw off the run. So you got to affect him in getting a pass rush. And he doesn't like it in his face. So that would be right up the middle. But I'm certain because of the injuries to Lattimore, to Paulson Adebo, and you trade Lattimore off, and now you've moved, you know, one of your corners who was basically a nickel corner, Alante Taylor, outside. Now I'm going to test them. I'm going to test them, see how well they can cover. And I think he's going to try to bait a little bit too. It'll be interesting with Tyrann Mathieu because I think he wants to go over the middle. He likes to throw that pass over the middle. And that may be more Njuku than anybody else. And he's 6'4.5". Mm-hmm. You know, so I think he's going to want to test Tyrann right over the top with a throw to the tight end. Because he likes that play. Because we've talked to him, and first thing he tells you is, man, I like that throw over the middle to the tight end because I'm always going to have the advantage with height. He's right.
Let me take a break. We'll talk a little bit LSU Gators when we come back. Mike Dettelier, our guest, 851, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. All right, 8:55 back to Mike Dettelier. One more Saints-Browns thing before we move on to Tigers-Gators. Mike, Jameis Winston, as I remember, is a pocket passer, so if you can get him off the spot, we don't really have to worry about containing him, right?
Well, no, he's not one to take off running. Every once in a while he will, but he likes to throw the football from the pocket. He feels comfortable there where he can set up, and then that ball comes out of that his hand fast. Mm-hmm. And it's a quick release. And so, yeah, what you're trying to do is to get some pressure on him, and especially up the middle, because, man, he's got his radar sort of tuned in to guys rushing him right up the middle. And when he starts to move, his accuracy rate drops off dramatically.
Think the Saints win the game?
I think it's close, Tommy.
Okay.
Man, that number on interim coaches in game two, mm-hmm. I don't think they've won. It's less than 20% of the games. Mm. That number, man, if Buddy was around, he would have every nickel right on Cleveland.
That would get
because
his attention.
That number is huge on interim coaches in game two. I think it's like 18% of the time that they win game two.
Well, let's hope that Jameis and the Browns are part of that 18%. Let's talk about Tigers,
yes.
Tigers, Gators real quick. Mike, what do you think?
This is one of the most underrated big-time rivalries in college football at one time. They didn't dislike one another, Tommy. They hated one another. And the other thing is Talent Bowl. Over the last 11 years, these two teams have produced 138 NFL draft choices. But last year, Florida produced one draft pick. Mm. Ricky Pearsall, first-round pick of the 49ers. It is dried up for them. Their defense doesn't look like – I remember Florida defenses looking like in the past. This has to be a get-well game for LSU because Florida is really not playing well. And, man, they're not real good. You know, this ain't Alabama. Put it to you that way. They struggling on both sides of the football. And Billy Napier, he's been given that dreaded kiss You're going to come back next year. Man, I don't know about that, Tommy. I really don't. Well, if Billy does survive.
He was in a conversation being the LSU coach, too.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. But that was from media. That wasn't from Scott Woodward. I knew Scott wasn't going to hire Billy.
Okay.
Wasn't going to happen.
So you think LSU wins, yes?
Yes. And I think it's a comeback game for LSU. And, man, if they don't bounce back offensively against this defense, man, LSU's in trouble down the stretch. And it's been a rough last six quarters for LSU offensively, not only on defense, also on offense.
All right, I'm going to hang on to the 18% second week coaching victory with the interim coaches because of the Cleveland Brown Jameis Winston effect. Thank you, Mike. We'll be listening tomorrow at 10 o'clock when the coverage starts with LSU, you and Herb Tyler, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Tiger Tailgating Show. When we come back, we're going to talk to Ian McNulty, who covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune. Well, keep them coming, because they were delicious. Bring a basket of them. Thank you, Dave. Have a great weekend. Ian McNulty joins us now, covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. It is our favorite time of week because we put the serious business aside, much like Fat Tuesday, where mirth and merriment reign. At this time, here on WWL on Friday, food and fun reign. And here's our king, Ian McNulty.
I am rising and shining to reign with you, Tommy. Thanks for having me on yet again, and thanks for the great intro. I actually do have a good segue from Dave's oranges. Mm-hmm. Last night I attended an event. It was a fundraiser called Midnight Market for the Crescent City Farmers Market. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of great restaurants there, the type of restaurants that support the farmers market. They show up, they prepare dishes using produce and goods from the vendors. There were just a lot of good ones. Akamaya, which is that new Mexican restaurant in the Bywater that a lot of people have been talking about. It's fantastic. Palm and Pine, always one of my favorites. Mr. Mao up on Chapultepec Street. Saba, Alon Shia's restaurant and magazine. A number of interesting pop-ups, Honey's, which is this great little cafe in the Marigny, right across from St. Rock Market, that does sort of interesting, coffee in the morning through wine in the evening, that kind of format of a restaurant. And recent oranges are on my mind. I left with a clutch of Satsumas that were just, they just tasted great. They tasted just way better than the ones I get in the store. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of just how good it is to have farmers markets in our neighborhoods. And in particular, this one, the Crescent City Farmers Market, they do a really impressive one on Sundays at City Park and the parking lot outside of Tad Gormley Stadium. Mm. It's the biggest one in the area, and it's the most vibrant, in my opinion. They made some changes during COVID, as we all did. And one of the things they did was loosen up the requirements for prepared foods. In the past, if you were going to sell anything at the farmer's market, it had to be grown locally, which is a great ethos in one respect, but in the other, no coffee, right? And I won't grow coffee around here. So they loosened that up for the people who are doing prepared food. So now when you walk around the farmer's market, you see all the vendors who are selling their produce. But there's a lot more just grab-and-go food, things to bring home, things to eat on the spot. And it really has changed the market into a place to go shop, but also a place to just kind of pig out on street food and find interesting little snacks and things to bring home, like I say, eat on the spot. And you see people setting up little picnics in City Park under the oaks. And just with the weather forecast that we got and how beautiful this weekend's going to be, just put on my back on my radar that farmer's market will be a great place to be. Just stomp around, fill up a bag with things to bring home and kind of forage your own free-form kind of brunch or lunch there on Sunday morning in City Park. So,
and unfortunately, unlike an article, we can't go back to read because now that you got everybody's attention. Tell us again where it is, Ian.
Yeah, actually, if you Google my name in Crescent City Farmers Market, I did have a recent article about it that would probably come right up. But it's in City Park.
Well, I could Google it, but I thought since you were here, you could just...
Yeah, sure. I'm right here. You can Google me.
That's what I thought.
It's in City Park, the Tad Gormley Stadium, Sunday mornings, I want to say 8 to noon, somewhere around that time frame. And they do several others. There's one in Mid-City, actually by where the old Brakes Tag Station was at the end of the bayou, which some of your longtime listeners will remember. It's kind of funny to see what had been this sort of broken piece of city bureaucracy that was that Brake Tag Station turned into something vibrant and then actually fresh and sort of joyful and uplifting, which is a farmer's market, in my opinion. And then there's a great one they do uptown, too, on Tuesdays. Right by where Broad meets River Road. Where Broadway meets River Road.
So it happens City Park Sunday mornings, 8 a.m. to noon, and that would be near what?
Tad Gormley Stadium.
Tad Gormley Stadium. Right,
off of, you're going down City Park Avenue. You've got Delgado right across the street. You've got Tad Gormley Stadium, and you'll see lots of cars and a cluster of colorful tents and food trucks and booths and wagons and such.
You know, so, when I was visiting my kid from out of town last time, I went to a farmer's market in North Louisiana, and those can be a lot of fun, especially in, like you're talking about, the weather as nice as it's going to be. Man, get out, take advantage of that.
Well, it's when I travel, Tommy, you know, if you're picture you're in a different city, mm-hmm. and you think, you know, I'm a little out of my rhythm. We're tourists. What are we going to do? We're going to go see kind of the life of the city. I'm often drawn to markets, whether it's a pop up farmers market or if they have sort of a more locals orientated version of what's become of our French market. You know, a lot of cities still have that, those old time markets where people go and convene and shop and people watch and munch things out of hands and sometimes have a drink. And, sometimes it's a good reminder that we do have these things in our backyard, homegrown local stuff that we can go explore on a sunny Sunday.
You know what I like to do when I'm traveling, Ian, to get a feel for the place? Believe it or not, go to a supermarket at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I know that sounds odd, but if you really want to get a taste for what Cleveland is like or Seattle, or you understand what I'm saying, because that's kind of where the vibe is at that point.
Absolutely. No, I send out-of-towners visiting New Orleans to grocery stores here all the time. I mean, it's a great place to stock up on some stuff to bring home, the kind of things they're trying to sell you in the gift store at the airport anyway. You just get them at the place where locals go shopping. You know, you go home with some crystals or some Tony Satcheries, that kind of thing. I mean, these are like legit exotic finds for people who aren't here and don't go shopping at a Dorniak's or a Robert's on a regular basis, you know? Right.
But if you really want to see and get the vibe for what a city's like, I found that to be the case.
Sure. No, I'm right there with you. I'm always going into grocery stores in other cities. And now what does their seafood section look like? You know, what do they have?
How expensive are they? Observe the people too, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I know in Hawaii, I saw in a market they had fish heads wrapped up. And I thought, what? Did we throw that away in Louisiana? What are you talking about? And apparently, fish head soup is a Hawaiian delicacy or something.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, that's where all the good meat is. You know, it's a shame what goes in the drink that we could be making good food out of.
But it was so bizarre to see fish heads wrapped with the styrofoam container and saran wrap covered. And it's like, what are you talking about? What? This garbage.
Well, I'm envisioning them wrapped in newsprint, which,
this was just like you buy ground beef, but it was fish heads.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can probably find that at some of the Asian markets around New Orleans. Hong Kong market comes to mind. If there's a tradition out there or a recipe or a way of cooking, somebody's going to meet it.
So where else you been eating? What else you been doing?
Yeah, here, another good intersection of food and sort of good vibes and uplift. There's an ongoing pop-up that happens twice a year, but it always takes a different form. And it's a weekday lunchtime thing downtown, and anytime I get a chance to go, I always find it very interesting. It's at Noki, which is the culinary school downtown. Noki stands for New Orleans Culinary and Hospitality Institute. And it's in that beautiful arts and crafts style building at the corner of Howard and Carondelet, right next to a great wine store, by the way, Keith and Company. Fabulous little emporium of wine and imported food and cheese. Just great. Looks like a like a Harry Potter library, but filled with wine and delicious things instead of spells. But anyway, that's a tangent. Gnocchi is across the street, and this is the culinary school that only opened a few years ago. They're only in their fifth year, but created by the local hospitality industry. The founders were T. Martin, who runs Commander's Palace, her cousin Dickie Brennan, who runs Dickie Brennan Restaurants, of course, George Brower, a local tax credit expert, investor, and they marshaled a lot of support and decided, you know, New Orleans were a restaurant town, were a great place to go visit restaurants. We should have more infrastructure in the city for people who want to advance in a culinary career, advance in a hospitality career, and don't have to go to the Culinary Institute of America up in New York or on the West Coast. So it's a really cool resource in our backyard, and it's different from those other culinary schools because it's not a two-year, four-year program. It's a six-month program. People are going through there not to get their college degree, but to get a certificate program so they can, you know, hit the ground running, jumpstart their career, get into management, become a captain at a restaurant, become a banquet manager at a hotel, whatever it is, and really can build their career. And the flip side of that is the local hospitality community gets a pipeline of better trained, better qualified, more experienced people, win, win, win. And this brings us to the pop-up. So each of those six-month classes, part of their curriculum is they plan, conceive, execute, and run a restaurant, their own pop-up restaurant within the culinary school. There's a ready-made restaurant space, and twice a year for each class, each semester of a class, they turn it into a different concept. And so that's going on right now. They'll have lunch today. They'll have a lunch Tuesday through Friday for the next few weeks, going to the middle of December, skipping the Thanksgiving week. And the theme this time around is Japanese food meets New Orleans food. So it's a fusion of familiar New Orleans stuff with Japanese culinary influences. They call it Bayou. Mm-hmm. And I hate spelling things on the radio, Tommy, but I have to for this one. It's B-A-I-U. Excuse me. This is why I hate spelling things on the radio.
B-A-I-Y-U with a hat on it, right?
There you go. Yeah. Exactly. You got it. Nailed it. But it's pronounced Bayou. And we went for lunch this week. You could have cocktails because, yes, Friday lunch service is included. It's New Orleans, okay? You can see that. To get right into the food, you're talking about char-grilled oysters with miso and panko breadcrumbs. You're talking about little wontons stuffed with boudin, so little boudin dumplings. And some of the finest cracklin I've had in a while. We talk about cracklin on your show, mm-hmm. Tommy, but a really good example there. And then you're getting into a nice tofu dish, a steak dish, a ramen. So it's fun. It's definitely very different. It's run like a normal restaurant. You walk in, there's a host. You see this open kitchen. You know, the waiter comes to your table, takes your order. But all of those people are culinary students. So your waiter is there not training to be a waiter, training to be a chef. And, you know, next week he or she will be working in the kitchen, whereas the people cooking your food today will be working the tables next week. And so it's an interesting experience because the lessons are going on all around you. I mean, the chef instructors are finding teachable moments. You're getting a different kind of meal, different pace, kind of the creation of these students. And you're encouraging them and supporting the school at the same time because the proceeds from the lunch, which you pay for, by the way, benefits the scholarship program for Gnocchi. So that was a very interesting lunch and sort of outing all in one, kind of a different thing to do.
If you go to nochi.org or Google Ian McNulty and NOCHI, you can find the story, I'm sure, or Bayou, B-A-I-Y-U with the little line over the U. But Ian, I'm trying to figure out the physical location of this. Where is it?
It's a really interesting spot, Tommy. It's at the corner of Howard and Carondelet downtown, okay. Right by, we're calling it Harmony Circle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was for years and years, like for decades, this building was invisible. It was covered with sheathing. And it was on the slate for demolition. Mm-hmm. No one really care that much because it was just such an ugly building. But then they started taking off the sheathing, the paneling, and they uncovered this, you know, early 1900s era five-story building with all this just gorgeous tile and cast stonework. And that became the basis for this eventually. I mean, it took a long time. There was an art hub that was supposed to go in there back before Katrina. That never happened. Building sat empty for a long time. It really did take visionaries in the hospitality community to turn it into what it is. And it's like I said, it's only been open and operating for a few years. A number of those years were during the pandemic. But it's the kind of place that has tremendous potential, I think, for the hospitality culture of New Orleans. And so it's interesting, as just an observer of it, as we are, to get a chance to go in, see what they're doing, learn about it, and hopefully encourage them, because I think they can do good things for New Orleans.
I think it is, as you said, win, 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 and add a couple of wins onto that. If you go to the site, you can even see the fall class of 24 and get up close and personal, see what they're all about, then go watch them cook and eat what they cooked. We'll take a break, come back. The questions are coming in for Ian McNulty, 504-260-1870. Of course, Ian. You know, with the weather, one of the more popular questions is going to be great outdoor eating places. We'll address that when we return on WWL. All right, Tommy Tucker here. Ian McNulty, our guest, as always. Google his name. You'll scroll down. You'll see a story that says this pop-up restaurant opened only 16 days. You'll see all the links you need there for Noki and Bayou, which, again, Ian, I think is just a fantastic thing all around, and thank you for bringing that up. Let's talk about outdoor places to eat, since I'm getting besieged with texts considering the weather's so nice.
Of course you are. This is the time to gulp it down, man. I mean, we could make a takeout box of this nice weather and bring it home.
Savor it, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Easy to find outdoor dining around town, but just that right spot, right? You just want to find that perfect spot. So let me take you through a couple examples, because, I mean, they vary widely from a place like Bacchanal down on the Bywater, which is, you know, casual as can be. You just go in, you're ordering these great cheese plates and wine. There's usually music playing. You're outside. It's fantastic. Right up the street, N7, more of a formal restaurant. In fact, a sleeper hit of a fantastic French restaurant with a killer wine list. And it's in this setting it's mostly outdoors. It's this covered patio, some covered, some open, a garden setting. It's all tucked behind this fence. You would never see it coming. I mean, it's over by the Press Street tracks on, let's call it, the lakeside of St. Claude Avenue. And it is not the place where you're going to expect this, like, really first-class restaurant in a lush landscape setting. But that dissonance is actually part of the thrill of going there. It's just a really, really fun place. But then, you know, you want something totally casual. If you're over on the West Bank in Algiers, Algiers has got a pretty good little restaurant scene cooking up there now. Mm-hmm. Barracuda Tacos is all outdoors. I mean, there's no piece of indoor into the place at all. It's that old filling station in the middle of Algiers Point that they've turned into a taco stand. Really good tortillas, which is the key to any taco to me. Good margaritas. And then right around the corner, you've got Nighthawk. This is right by the ferry landing. Real good Neapolitan-style pizza, you know, the pizza that comes out of the wood-burning oven. Good cocktails there, too. A nice martini. Like I said, right by the ferry landing, if you're going to make a river outing out of it. This one has a cozy dining room and bar, but in the back, a little patio, kind of hidden in the back there, just tucked away. This is the time of year too. I like to remember the restaurants that we talk about a lot during crawfish season, the places that are boiled seafood specialists. Crawfish are not and should not be around right now. It's savor them for their proper season. But they're boiling shrimp and crabs. They're frying seafood. They're making all the other specialties. And these places are great for outdoor dining. I'm thinking of our Jason Sider's place in Harahan, which is that's premium outdoor dining right there. Not premium in price, just premium in atmosphere and the feel of it, and casual bucket of beer kind of place. It's got music on the weekends too. The tiki torch is probably flickering in the wind over in Mid City. Klessy's Seafood on Bienville Street, set up in a similar fashion with a big outdoor patio. And here's the one I get a lot. Okay, I've talked about a lot of places in the city, in Orleans Parish, and yes, Algiers Point included the city, of course. But it's harder not to crack is out in the suburbs, just because the buildings, the way that, you know, even the commercial areas were developed, just don't lend themselves as much to the old patios and porches and that sort of thing. not a lot of courtyards out there, right? But if you look around Metairie Road these days, that's different. Metairie Road is turned into a real restaurant row, wending through Old Metairie, and there's a lot of new build stuff there with outdoor dining built in. I'm thinking as casual as the new Felipe's right there along Metairie Road, built with a lot of outdoor dining capabilities to it. You've got Garrison, which is the old Garden Gates landscaping spot that people remember from years back. It's a great restaurant now with a terrific, very stylish dining room, an open kitchen where you can sit along the counter and watch the meals come together. And then these individual gazebos outside that you can reserve that have their own TVs and their own heaters and fans for whatever the weather's doing to you. A smaller menu out there, a little bit more of a more almost a tavern menu of sandwiches and snacks and such, but a real nice setting. And even across the street, Tana, which is the Michael Galata's upscale Italian restaurant, has a little patio in the back. And then go around the corner, just off Metairie Road, right on Airline, in that little triangle spot there between Airline and Causeway, you've got Las Cruces for casual, family-friendly Tex-Mex with a big bar, tacos, fajitas, that kind of thing, and a very big outdoor area. And if you know the timing is right, you'll be out there sipping your margarita, and a freight train will come chugging by, just you know, a stone's throw away, which I actually think is really cool and highly entertaining for the kiddos.
And you know what? If you have enough margaritas in you, maybe you hop on, you get off the grid, leave it all behind.
Yep.
Pay your bill. Pay your bill first, but then hop on the freight.
Yeah, sling your handkerchief, tie your handkerchief around the sticks over your shoulder, and you're Hobo Joe.
I'm not encouraging dine and dash, to be clear. If you want to leave it all behind you, that's fine, but pay your bill first. What about, I want to talk about Gretna, too, because I don't want to let my friend Belinda Constant down. It's amazing the outdoor dining places that they have in Gretna. I love the River Shack. You just sit up there, watch the Crescent City Connection lights, and just feel a river breeze.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, sometimes the best view of the city is from the other bank, you know, from the other side. And that's a great example. The River Shack, of course, the original over in Jefferson. This one just on the other side of the river, but it has that elevated deck up there. That's real nice. And then don't forget Gattuso's, a few blocks away within the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. They did some major upgrades to their front patio there. So that's a nice spot, too, for casual eats.
Weekend breakfast places outside real quick.
Well, let's stay in Gretna. Toast Gretna, right over in Hancock. Toast has a couple locations in the city, and this one is built around outdoor dining. There's even an outdoor bar for your breakfast drinks and a playground for your kids to run off some of the syrup and chocolate sauce.
And other places where you can eat outside breakfast?
Breakfast outdoors. Oh, go to Mid-City. La Ponce. This is one of my new favorite spots. It is super casual coffee shop. We might have talked about it before. It's right behind Cafe Degas off of Esplanade Avenue. And it is a casual French cafe, walk-up order at the counter. Great breakfast sandwiches, great pastries, good coffee. And it's right near City Park, so you can start your weekend with breakfast at La Ponce and then go to City Park, walk it off, go to that farmer's market we talked about on Sunday by Tag Gourmet Stadium. You know, you can make a whole weekend out of it, just with what Tommy and Ian were talking about on Friday.
Broken Egg has some outdoor dining, I think, and I'm trying to think of some of the other places that have outdoor dining.
Sure, yeah, the Ruby Slippers have that.
Ruby Slippers have that, sure.
Yeah, Brunch Specialist. They've got a couple, two in Metairie now, both with outdoor dining, one on Vets, one again on Metairie Road, that part of that restaurant row I mentioned. And in Mid-City, right off Broad and Banks, they're the big location there. It's got a large outdoor area, too.
Here we go, Ian. Somebody wants to know, they're going to GW Finn's, one of your favorite places. They want to know a must-have.
Sure. Ask them if they have the dry-aged tuna. They do not always. It's a specialty item that they get in, and they dry-age it in-house. Just trust me on this. It's you want to split it for two of you. It's extraordinary, but if they don't have it, that's okay. You're still in luck. I always start with the lobster dumplings, even though it's one of the few things on the menu that's not actually from the Gulf with that lobster. Anything raw that they're doing, you know, it's going to be so fresh, and the way that they dress it up is great. and try, just if you want to go out on a limb, trust yourself. Get the tuna if you're a tuna guy. Get the redfish if you're a redfish gal. But go on a limb for the fin's wings. They're the cut right by the fin of the fish. It's got the sweetest, most tasty morsels of meat attached to the bone. They fry it. They season it perfectly with a little sweet heat, and you'll thank yourself. It's like eating the finest fish, chicken wing style, and it's just one of the wonderful things they do there with the local catch at GW Fest.
Never enough time, Ian McNulty, as always. I owe you an old-fashioned for this. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again soon, all right?
Thanks again, as always, for the opportunity to talk about the team that never loses, New Orleans food culture, and Go Saints this weekend. Thanks a lot, Tommy.
You got that right. Thank you, Ian McNulty. We'll take a break. Speaking of Go Saints, we'll get some winners with JR from Tegan Vegas. 941 traffic now, WWL. All right, here we go, 9:47, 13 till 10, another favorite time of week. We talk to JR with Taken Vegas. Try to help you have some fun this football weekend without just throwing your money out the window, because there's no future in that, is there, JR?
There is no future in it. And first off, happy Football Friday to you and everybody in the New Orleans area. We are here to do one thing and one thing alone, and that is help everybody make some money this weekend with their football and basketball bets. Big time winner last night, by the way. Thank you to all of you, LSU. Plus the 8+ points last night. They win outright, an easy winner in college hoops. And we're going to do it again this weekend, guys. Huge winner this week in college football. I'm going to give you the winner of this LSU-Florida game. You guys are going to the Swamp to take on the Gators. The line is LSU -4. I've got this point spread winner locked up for you absolutely free. All you got to do is text the word WIN to 545454, and you'll get the winner of LSU Florida free of charge, again, via text message. All you got to do, text the word WIN to 545454 and get the point spread winner of LSU Florida free via text.
Now, let me tease this, because JR always gives us an on-air pick, and these on-air picks are 10-1 this year. If you'd been going with JR's on-air picks, you'd be building a house in the Rocky Mountains.
No question about it. How about that lake house? I'm still wondering about that lake house of yours, Tommy.
I decided to go
to
Rocky.
Get.
I'm concerned with flood insurance, so I decided to go with the Rocky Mountains instead. Let's talk about
climate change and everything, you should definitely be worried about the lake taking over your house.
All right, let's talk about that, about, you know, like you mentioned, college hoops. A lot of us can't follow every sport. And even with that, we don't want to follow it with our heart. You want to follow it with your head. You want to do the math. You want to watch money lines. Talk about how you help manage people's money, JR.
Well, at the beginning of the year, especially in college basketball, just college sports in general, the portal has thrown quite the monkey wrench into the gears for most guys that were really good at handicapping college basketball in the past. You'd always look at how many returning starters, you look at, you know, the matchups, the height differences. There's a lot to look at in college basketball, where now, because of the portal and the big, you know, shakeup in personnel around the league, it's quite hard if you don't have the resources and you don't have the people in place to be able to find things out. It's going to be nearly impossible, especially for that first month of the season, to be able to find ways to make money in college, period, whether it's college basketball, college football. So, you know, we've got the resources and the people in place that have been doing this forever, and we don't have one person who's in charge. We have a whole slew of individuals, and we're capable of putting that information together and coming out with what we think is going to be the right side of games. And look, we don't win every game, but we hit an astronomical percentage for our clientele. We do win way more than we're ever going to be able to lose. And it comes down to managing, you know, the bankroll that I think is most important. And we talk about that all the time here on air. So, you know, don't go at it alone. Have an expert in your corner. You know, have somebody that not only is going to be able to give you the right sides of games, but also help you manage what you should be doing as far as percentage-wise of your bankroll on each and every game.
And what's terrible is people make ill-informed decisions. Then what do they do? Double down on another ill-informed decision. That's senseless.
It really is. And that's what we call, I can't tell you how many guys, Tommy, I talk to that utilize a negative progression, which is insanity to me. It just doesn't work. You are betting on the fact that you're just not going to lose again and again until you're out of money. So, you know, those of you who bet only, let's say, $100 on a game, you lose the game, you're like, ah, I want to get back my 100 and still make 100. And you double up and you go 200 on the next one, 400, 800. Before you know it, you're down $1,600 and you're a $100 player and your $2,000 bankroll is down to nearly nothing. Don't allow that to happen. Those are horrible decisions. You should be going in the opposite direction when things don't go your way. And I don't do knee-jerk reactions. You know, we're not here to tell you to lower your bet after just one loss, but based on net wins, net losses, you should absolutely change the amounts that you're betting, and you want to increase as you're winning, but you don't want to go too far. You don't want to double up after each game. You want to add maybe 20% or 50% after 2, 3, 4, 5 games that have you net wins in your direction. But again, this is going to come down to you being able to make money and getting on the right side of games, and it will start with this winner tomorrow at 2:30 Central between LSU and Florida. Call the number. Excuse me. All you got to do is text the number, and I'm going to send it to you via text message. Send the word WIN to 545454. Get the winner of LSU Florida via text message for free. Just text WIN to 54 54 54.
But I mean, just think about what you're saying. You make a bad choice, you make a bad bet, so what are you going to do? You go double it up to try to get it back, but you don't have any further information, which is silly, and that's what your service provides.
Absolutely. And plus, we are that voice of reason. We are the ones that are explaining to you not only what you should be betting, but also why you should be putting in a certain amount on each and every game that you bet. And again, helping you make those increases and decreases is why our clientele, they look at their bankroll almost like, you know, a portfolio, an investment, right? So they say, okay, my bankroll this year, I started out when I got with JR, I had a $5,000 bankroll. At the end of week one, I had $6,000, which may not sound like a lot, but guys, that's 20%. If your portfolio in the stock market was doing that over 365 days, you're doing cartwheels. So if you could do that in one weekend, going from 5K to 6K, that's a big jump. And we're not doing it by betting $1,000 on a game. We're doing it in increments. So you got to look at the big picture. And then we take that 6,000, we turn it into 8,000. Before you know it, a couple of months later, that $5,000 bankroll in 2 months has quintupled and you got 25K sitting in your account. That's what we do. That's what we provide. We show guys how to do it the right way. And again, it's about not panicking when you lose and taking advantage when you win.
Now I want you to be the voice of a free on-air pick.
All right. So again, we are 10-1. Asterisk on that one. Again, I'm not going to explain that one.
I'll explain. It rained. It rained, and it was a last-minute rainstorm. Nothing you can do about that. Go ahead.
Nothing. And so let's get right into another big winner this week. NFL is where I'm going to be taking you once again. This one is going to be on Sunday Night Football, guys. You got the Bengals going into L.A. to take on the Chargers. Chargers are a 1.5-point favorite in this matchup. The Chargers cannot score. Yes, they have a fantastic defense. You would think that might slow Cincinnati down, but Cincinnati, they don't have an issue with being able to score points. They have an issue with being able to stop opponents. I could tell you right now, the Bengals are going to score a lot in this matchup, more than you would expect against a Charger defense that has really slowed down their opponents, but I don't like it. I love it. I believe that the Bengals win this game outright. They're going to do it in absolute top form, and they're going to do this in double digits. Look for the Bengals to win this game between 10 and 14 points outright.
Take us out, JR.
Hey, again, guys, let's get on the right side of things. It starts out with this big winner between LSU and Florida. It is yours absolutely free via text message. All you got to do, text the word WIN to 545454. Get the winner of LSU Florida free of charge right now via text message. Last week I told you to do that for the Alabama-LSU game. I know you guys lost, but if you texted, I told you to get in Alabama. So unfortunately your team lost, but you made money. Do it again this week. I've got the right side of this matchup. I'll let you know if LSU is going to cover on the road at the Swamp. Text WIN to 545454 and get that winner free of charge via text message. Again, WIN to 545454. As always, Tommy, pleasure being on with you. And guys, be safe, have fun, and go out there and make some money.
Yeah, you're right.